Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, a weekly discussion of current events in China. I'm your host, Kaiser Guo. Joining me today in the pop-up Chinese studios here in Beijing are Cynical regulars Gotti Epstein, bureau chief of Forbes in Beijing, who will be co-hosting with me today. How are you, Gotti?
Good, Kaiser, thanks.
It's a very, very good beard there, Gotti.
Thank you.
And Jeremy Goldhorn, a.k.a. Jin Yumi, creator of the Uber blog Danwei.org. Before I introduce our special guest this week, I wanted to announce that we are giving away a signed copy of Jonathan Watts' new book, When a Billion Chinese Jump, which we talked about 3 weeks ago here on this podcast. To enter, just send an email to contest@popupchinese.com with the subject heading Jump, and we'll pick a lucky winner. Today, a very special podcast, we welcome Shannon Van Sant, a contributor to PBS Television's NewsHour and the Nightly Business Report, and five-year resident of Beijing. Welcome, Shannon.
Thank you.
Shannon's also a documentary filmmaker. One of her works was recently broadcast. It's called China versus the U.S., A Race for Resources in Africa. And it's for her work in Africa that we invited her here today to talk about today's topic, which, of course, is China in Africa. I thought we'd start today just by sort of going through the standard narrative, the set of tropes or memes or whatever that have emerged around China in Africa.
Not surprisingly, the dominant initial narrative about China going anywhere is a bit cynical, the notion that they are there to get resources, that the jobs they create are just at the very low end of the scale, that it's a purely extractive, exploitive relationship.
That they're abetting in the horrors of all these human rights violating
and
regimes.
Then
Robert Mugabe,
they attach no conditions, so they're
let's go through these one
Zimbabwe.
By one. And maybe we can use that as sort of a frame to hang this whole conversation on, point by point. I guess the first thing that most of us believed is that this push into Africa is something relatively recent, that Chinese from, the big oil companies down to the scrappy little Zhejiang merchants all kind of showed up just in time for Beijing to hold its big Africa Fest in November of 2006, the Forum on Chinese-African Cooperation, during which I think it was something like more than 90% of all African heads of state were here in Beijing. Jeremy, you remember what it was like here during that time, right?
I was actually involved. I was the media advisor to the then president of South Africa, Mbeki, for his media interviews in Beijing. And he ended up canceling all of them except CCTV. Because of this, I was at the China World Hotel for much of the time where a lot of the delegates were staying and ended up socializing with people from all over the continent.
So pretty much every African nation except for those that still sort of cling to recognition of Chinese Taipei as the Republic of China were all in attendance.
That's correct. And if it wasn't the head of state, it was a very senior official.
Wow, really very impressive. But this idea that it's new is one that I know at least Deborah Rodigam's book really challenges. And she actually lays out quite a bit of history. It's actually fascinating. That goes all the way back to the Mao years. And I guess pretty significantly, the interregnum between the craziness of the Great Leap Forward and the craziness of the Cultural Revolution, those years from 61 to 65 when Liu Shaoqi and Deng Xiaoping were in charge, it seems that that was the era in which the really kind of big push for Sino-African cooperation was going down. And a good time for that, too, because this is sort of the first rise of the technocrats in the post-Mao period, and there was more sort of Soviet-style big infrastructure projects. This is the time when things like the Tazara, the Tanzam Railroad was getting started, which is probably the most well-known of the Chinese infrastructure projects in Africa, and which is still sort of hobbling along, running today. And that's a big part of Howard French's piece, right? He rides that.
Right, he starts there. And, of course, it was a different era of political sort of intervention and development rather than today's more economically driven sort of, I mean, of course, political today, too, but in a different way.
But that's one that we can sort of knock off right away, then. It's not a new phenomenon. It didn't spring fully formed as sort of a strategic move in the mid-2000s, right? I don't know if I know that South Africa was really late to recognizing China, that it was a...
Yeah, well, I mean, South Africa, was a pariah state when I was growing up.
Right.
Taiwan was becoming not a pariah state, but one that was struggling to find allies. Taiwan in the 80s invested quite a lot of money in South Africa. The Chinese had actually supported the Pan-African Congress, which is today a little-known party that was one of the other liberation parties aside from the ANC. They weren't particularly strong supporters of the ANC, who had big Soviet backing. But they were a little bit involved. So everyone expected as soon as there was a new government, they would flip from Taiwan to the mainland. But it actually took a little time in 1997. And it came as a surprise to the Taiwanese, who were very displeased. They were basically just told one day, sorry, we're switching. So 98, basically, the embassy was established here.
Shannon, you did a lot of your reporting for that last documentary from Zambia, right, which is usually sort of one of the test cases that people use. It's that in Angola. And my sense is that because of the focus on these two countries and because they're both sort of mineral-rich countries, in the case of Zambia, it's copper, Angola, oil, that's kept alive this second, you know, piece of the narrative, which is that it's all about extractive resources. It's all about, you know, the extractive industry getting in there. Was that your sense from your trip to Africa, that that's the main focus of Chinese policy there?
Well, I mean, I think it's multifold. Certainly in Zambia, that's the main focus in Zambia, and it depends from country to country. You look at Angola and Nigeria, the main demand is for oil. But in terms of medical aid, which I'm researching now, research is more, or the aid is more driven perhaps by politics, and by soft power and diplomacy. So I think it's equal parts forming long-term friendships with these African countries and in the process as well extracting the resources they need.
Right.
Yeah.
I thought that one of the most interesting things that I read in Deborah Brottingham's book is this idea that sure, yes, they are building infrastructure for resource kind of deals. They're doing these sorts of deals. They're being paid by the Angolans in oil. They're being paid by the Zambians essentially in copper. And these in-kind deals are actually inspired from China's own experience as an aid recipient in the 1970s, in the late 1970s, right after reform and opening began, especially from Japan. This was talked about in some of the readings that we'd passed around. Gadi, you...
Right, they did basically a resource for infrastructure deal with Japan. And so the argument goes that what they're doing is just replicating their own experience there. They're trading their ability to come in and build infrastructure for resources. And I guess the big question is, you know, kind of raised in the Howard French piece as well, is this a long-term strategy that will help Africa, or are they just kind of going in, building stuff that will crumble and decay, and getting out with the resources?
I suppose that really just simply remains to be seen. I mean, you can't know what's going to happen with some of these infrastructure.
But you can get a sense of what's their attitude towards it on the ground, and I'm sure you saw a lot.
Well, I think two things.
Shannon.
Yeah, going off of Brottingham's point that this is a replication of what Japan did and China, is if you have the same sort of optimistic viewpoint on Africa, I think that in some ways is too optimistic. I mean, you're dealing with countries like Chad and the Congo, even Zambia, which has been a relatively stable country, and places I don't know if we can count on them to have the same effective schemes for privatization, for economic development over the next several decades. Maybe. But I think that's a very big maybe. And the other point that I think French made in that Atlantic article, which is something that I saw on the ground in Zambia, is the question you have to ask is, are living standards for these people rising? And have they risen since Chinese investors and also Indian and Russian and Brazil and this demand for commodities? Has it resulted in an increase in living standards?
And in Zambia, what's your answer?
In Zambia, where I went to, it hasn't. Okay. And I think if you look at, like, Nigeria, Nigeria's GDP next year is set to exceed South Africa's. But still, most of the country lives well below the poverty line, and you have religious riots every year that kill hundreds of people. So the question is China can build roads, it can build stadiums, it can build schools, and the U.S. is doing some of this as well through aid. But those roads and that infrastructure they don't matter if you don't have goods or meaningful sources of economic growth to transport imports and exports down those roads, other than copper that's going to China and oil that's going to China.
Right. China's built out of its road network, and the construction that they did do on the back of that Japanese aid was paired with major agricultural reforms.
That's right.
And lifting, as you know, we famously know, a couple hundred million people out of poverty in the early 80s.
Or getting out of the way and allowing themselves to lift themselves out of poverty.
Exactly, where we don't have the same kind of parallel thing going on in Africa.
And there are cultural factors which make it unwise to think that Africa could just replicate the Chinese experience. And, I mean, I think the most notable of which is the ethnic problems in Africa. I mean, almost all African countries are basically colonial fictions. They weren't countries before the colon and the European, mainly French and British, came along and drew lines in the map. And most African countries include a number of ethnic groups that often don't like each other. And often, you know, if you look at, say, a very extreme example, Rwanda, Burundi, and Eastern Congo, they're the same ethnic groups replicated, not replicated, the same ethnic groups in these three countries. Within one country, they don't get along. You know, there's problems arising from the fact that the same ethnic group will support their fellows in the other country.
Right.
So, you know, one of the causes of all the wars in Africa, whether they have been called, a war between communists and capitalists or, you know, since independence, has been tribal and ethnic rivalries. China doesn't have this. I mean, China is 90% Han. And although there is a huge variety of Han Chinese people, there's this incredibly unifying culture.
Yeah, there aren't these ethnic schisms. And yes, this is definitely something. I mean, this is manifested in Sudan, of course, in Nigeria, of course, where perennially, as you were saying, there are religious wars, you know, between Muslim North and more animist South.
Well, you have these, and I think that raises an interesting point about what I've seen in this literature that we were talking about is some conflicting notions about whether the conditionality of Western lending is a good or bad thing, or, well, let's just say a good, or is it ineffectual? You saw some stuff in this French piece about, you know, from people on the ground saying, look, without that, we wouldn't have the civil society we do have now. But on the other hand, you had some arguments, I think, in the book that you're mentioning, The Dragon's Gift, that what they need is more Chinese-style sort of development model in these countries where they have not, you know, take democracy out of the way and actually just get things done.
Yeah, it's not exactly like China could credibly go promoting democracy abroad,
right,
when it doesn't exactly have it at home.
Right, but the implication or essentially the statement being that the conclusion being that democracy in these countries, they weren't ready for it, and so this money gets wasted, this sort of development investment gets wasted, and the implication is that it might be better under this sort of Chinese wave of investment. What do you think, Shannon?
I don't know. It makes me think. I'm doing a lot of research right now into Peru, Chinese investment there. And there are a lot of parallels, I think, between Peru and some countries like Zambia. And if you look at, say, South Africa or Peru or some countries which have stronger restrictions on Chinese investment there, it has good results, potentially some good results. I did some reporting in South Africa as well, and for the construction company, Chinese construction company I was profiling, they were required to hire a majority African workforce. They also had very rigorous safety standards. It was top of the line, and of course the conditions in Zambia were quite different. And so I think there's an argument to, it's up to each individual country to take this money and to manage it effectively, potentially.
That's an interesting point. I mean, this is something that I feel like gets lost in the conversation often. There's this kind of people don't ascribe enough agency to the African countries themselves. I mean, as though, you know, they don't really have a choice in the matter either. You know, it's either the white Europeans and the North Americans calling shots, or it's the Chinese calling shots. And when in fact the people who ought to be calling the shots are they themselves, right?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Well, you don't exactly have, though, the very effective governments, you know, who are making these deals.
Not in all cases.
You have an agency problem, like, for instance, in the Congo, right, where you have deals being made to build roads to the guy who negotiated the deal,
sure,
to his villa or to the chief of police's estate, you know, that aren't roads for, you know, the population.
Right. Related to this human rights problem, I mean, this allegation, I think that's just pretty implicit that in offering sort of no strings attached aid as an alternative to the strings attached sort, they are, you know, thwarting the healthy development of rule of law, of human rights, of democracy. That's, you know, one of the more serious allegations and one that we should, you know, talk about a whole lot more. Related to that, of course, is corruption. There's this idea that China is essentially buying the good favor of political elites who themselves are inherently corrupt.
regular podcast sound regular effect pod, right.
Sound effect
of a beverage opening.
Of the Yinjing beer can. It's very
I think on that note, I think we can have Jeremy address this corruption issue.
Right,
well lubricated for the discussion.
Well, I think that, those concerns are valid. I tend to come at it from a point of view that's much more cynical about Western countries' activities in China and the effect of conditional aid. I've recently more and more coming around to the viewpoint that is expressed in a very good thin book called Dead Aid.
Yeah, by Lisa Moyle.
In which she makes the case that aid has had a corrupting effect on African culture, society, governments, and the economy. And she's quite positive about China's involvement in Africa. And I think one of the sort of pillars of this argument is that even if China is doing deals with corrupt political elites, at the point at which China can no longer do good business, they will leave. This puts a much greater pressure, in theory, on the governments to do the right thing in Africa, because they're not getting the aid because Westerners feel guilty. They're getting the aid because it makes business sense for China. And I'm sympathetic to that point of view.
Yeah, I don't like to think that it's just such a stark choice between, a high-minded scold on the one hand and just a simple, reliable commercial partner. There's a middle ground.
I don't think it's that black and white, but, I think the reliable commercial partner aspect of China's involvement in Africa is not that side of the story doesn't get told very well in the Western media.
And I also think, just speaking from personal experience, as part of the same trip, I went to Uganda and the southern border of Sudan. And in that area, aid organizations had recently left. The Lord's Resistance Army had dominated the area for a while. And after the army left, the aid organizations left. And when I was there, a number of refugees were being returned home after spending time in the IDP camps. And there were problems with starvation and malnourishment, mm-hmm. AIDS. And the people there at the border kept asking me, is the U.S. going to come? Are you part of this U.S. team to help us? We need food. We need medicine. We need this. We need that. And my Ugandan guides just said, look around you. This land is fertile. And there's no reason that people here should be starving. But that even in this time of war and bloodshed, now it's a time of calm. And people have not learned to be self-sufficient.
There's still this aid dependency sort of mentality there.
Speaking of this fertile land, so this issue I think Justin Lin is an advocate of the notion that Chinese agribusiness come to Africa and sort of help kind of modernize African farming.
Justin Lin Yifu was the Taiwan-born, actually swam across the straits to China, now the chief economist for the World Bank.
Right, and sometimes talked up for a Nobel. And he... or maybe just by his advocates, but he was advocating this this notion that that the Chinese sort of help Africa modernize agriculture, but it's also, of course, a very sensitive point, this notion of land essentially being farmed out literally to foreign nations. Have you guys kind of come across this issue?
Yeah, Shannon? I mean, interesting. I think Deborah Brodingham, who's generally very, very sanguine about Chinese involvement in Africa, as you know from the title of the book itself, she's actually very wary about, agriculture. She says, there's this sort of deep-rooted sense of the sacredness of the land or whatever. And this is, apt to cause a whole lot more problems than even, extractive industries.
In Zambia, the anger towards Chinese immigrants and Chinese investors was across the board in every part of the country I went to. But some of the fiercest anger towards Chinese immigrants I found was in the chicken auctions in Lusaka. And there you would see some Chinese chicken sellers side by side with the Zambian chicken sellers. And the Zambians would come up to me and they would say, the Chinese, they're dominating the chicken sales and their farms are dominating our business and we're losing business because of them. And there were rumors flying that they were injecting chickens with hormones to make their chickens bigger. And
the Chinese?
They would never do that.
Right. But it was interesting. I think what she says in terms of...
But there is, you know, another side to this too, that we just ran an article by Tessa Thornley on Dunway about China in Africa, and it focused on Chinese entrepreneurs, not the big state-owned infrastructure and resource projects, but looking at Chinese who try and run businesses in Africa, of which there are an increasing number. You can pretty much go to any African country, a small town, you will find a Chinese store of some kind in small towns. I mean, South Africa certainly is that way now, and many African countries have followed the same pattern. So you have Chinese business people who look at Africans as customers. And this, to me, is a very positive development. I don't think any Western country, the West has not looked on Africa as a land of opportunity. And I think that there are Chinese people who are doing that now. Now, this doesn't mean everything is going to be rosy, because I think Zambia is a case in point that Chinese entrepreneurs in Africa are going to annoy a lot of Africans, because they're going to be able to do better business because they have networks that allow them to get cheap prices to buy stuff in China, because they have a kind of entrepreneurial culture that is lacking in most parts of Africa. But there is a very positive side to it, too.
Yeah, Jeremy, I think you raised a really good point. It's not all top-down. It's not all government-mandated or big state enterprises at all, right?
I think that's a really important point. And I read Tessa's article, and what she says, I noticed in South Africa, particularly in Johannesburg, and in one factory, one Chinese-owned factory, small factory in Zambia, is that when you have small-scale entrepreneurs like that, whether it's small factory owners or shop owners or restaurant owners, they're integrated into the local population, into the neighborhood, and they're able to interact with South Africans or Zambians in a way that maybe eases that tension. And in South Africa, some of the African employees of these Chinese entrepreneurs were saying, we love working with them. They in a way understand pain and discrimination that we have felt that a white maybe shop owner would not be able to understand or feel.
Good point.
Whereas in Zambia and the copper mines, or with some of the construction companies, you look at the Chinese workers tend to be managerial, they tend to be engineers, and then you have a base of this African workforce. And then those engineers and those managers tend to be very isolated. They live separate from the rest of the population. They're bused to the compound and they're bused back home, and they eat in their own dining halls, and they don't really interact or engage with the population in a way that I think might ease tension.
It's part of this counter narrative to this, the one that we were talking about at the beginning of the show here. The bottom-up counter-narrative, which says that these little guys who are, you know, these real entrepreneurial, scrappy businessmen from Zhejiang and from Fujian have actually done more for Africa than Bob Geldof and Bono and Tony Blair all rolled into one. And they've done it because they've shown up in Africa. They've seen opportunities. For example, here we are in this city where there are a ton of aid workers or a ton of NGOs constantly flying in with not a decent hotel to stay in town. And so they build one. They build, you know, a Chinese-style three-star hotel with a decent breakfast service. And suddenly, you know, they're making a little bit of money. And they need to pave the road to get people to and from the hotel. And so that happens. Then they need cellular service. So they call their friend who works for Huawei or for ZTE. And the next thing you know, there's a bid for a cellular provider that's based around this new sort of Chinese-based infrastructure that's in place. And then this stuff does last. I mean, cellular networks are, an unambiguous benefit to the conduct of commerce in any of these countries. And so, yeah, this was sort of the first persuasive case that I had heard about. I mean, when I was reading, I think it was a piece in Granta maybe 3 or 4 years ago that was making this basic assertion that it's these scrappy entrepreneurs from the south of China who are really transforming the face of Africa from the bottom up. And it's not Sinopec or PetroChina that necessarily are doing it.
That makes a lot of sense to me.
Good.
Right. Well, is that sort of benefit, does the sum of those benefits mean that we should basically not be putting too much attention on sort of the negatives, like at the top, the sort of dealings with...
That would be against our very nature.
Right. Well, I mean, what I mean is, are we overplaying the sort of the negative story about like Sudan or Zimbabwe? Are there long-term gains from the overall continental sort of investments.
Well, I think the point is with so many things when you're talking about China is just don't be swayed by this monolithic notion. It's not a uniform continent at all. It's not. I mean, obviously, it's different in all cases. But you know, most Americans I know have an appalling knowledge of the geography of Africa.
Right.
I mean, it's truly appalling. And Evan Osnos was on the show not too long ago, and afterward we were wrapping up and talking about doing a future podcast on China and Africa. Unfortunately, he is under deadline. He was unable to join us. But he was talking about a conference that he had attended recently on aid and development in Africa. And, of course, the big thing under discussion was what China's role is. There weren't any Chinese people present. It was all either Europeans or North Americans, and then Africans themselves. He said that there was a stark color divide when it came to attitudes toward China. He said that anyone who was white was warning them against this neo-imperialist threat from the East, while anyone of color was, had their arms out in open embrace and said China's the best thing that's ever happened. I thought that was really interesting, and it's too bad that we don't have Evan here to talk about that. But I'm sure that's an oversimplification, and there are plenty, as you know. Okay, Shannon, you talked to Michael Sata. You interviewed him for that piece.
Michael Sata is a politician in Zambia. He ran for president in 2006 and 2008. He plans to run again next year. Mm-hmm. And his popularity surged in Zambia after an explosives factory. There was an accident at a factory. The explosion was actually in 2005 in the Copper Belt, and some workers, about 50 people died. They were making explosives for the mines, and the factory blew up. And so his popularity surged. He campaigned basically on this anti-Chinese sentiment. And he's a very interesting man.
The people who died in the explosion were Zambians.
And they were all Zambians.
There were Chinese staff at the site who got away. And
right.
That was the rumor, at least.
Yeah, there were no Chinese staff killed, about 49 Zambians who died. And the rumor, some of the family members of victims that I talked to, the rumor is that the Chinese may have known about it and then maybe left. So it was a really traumatic event, and those families, everyone's really closely tied in the Copper Belt, so everyone knew or was related to someone who died in that accident. So Sada is an interesting man, and he campaigned on this anti-Chinese platform. His statements against the Chinese, although he still has these sort of pat statements, like the Chinese are investors, they're not investors, he has...
It's clever.
He's drawn back a little bit. He now says that if he is elected, he'll do business with the Chinese, but he will manage the investment in a better way. He says he will not be corrupt like the current administration.
Is that allegation sound? Is the current administration corrupt when it comes to their dealings with Chinese mine owners?
Well, there's no hard evidence of that, but certainly the feeling on the ground in Zambia is there's a deep feeling amongst everyone I spoke with, that the benefits of that investment is not reaching them. And so the question is, okay, well, we know that there's money here and there are jobs here because of Chinese investment, but why are our wages lower? Why do we not have healthcare benefits?
But seriously, really, is there a corruption in an African-Chinese, resources deal? I mean, of course.
Really, you think? And there's this other thing Chinese loans are always earmarked for Chinese vendors. That the low wage, low value add, low skill jobs will maybe devolve to the natives, whereas anything better, higher paying, that requires a little more skill, inevitably goes to the Chinese. What about these two pieces of the meme?
Well, I think French touched on this on his article for The Atlantic, and just that if the Chinese, if this economic development is going to be sustainable, at least one part of it is having a trained and highly skilled labor force. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't see from my time in Zambia how these workers were learning skills that would enable them to move up the work chain or the social chain. And that's what they were telling me as well. They said, look, we're the lowest of the low, and we are not getting the education and the training we need. There's no mobility, and we don't see any chance or future for higher wages.
And this is where the things are a little bit different when you compare Africa and China in terms of foreign investment. China has the market leverage to tell foreign companies that they have to train their workers at a high level, or that they have to, transfer technology. Of course, they're at that stage now where they can do that. They've done that with, let's say, Airbus, making planes in Tianjin and flying Chinese staff to Europe for management training.
But Africa.
Transferring knowledge and technology. Right. And there's just, I would say, there's probably zero of that or close to that going on with investment in Africa.
Yeah, I mean, and for those people who say that, you know, China is replicating its experience from the late 70s, I mean, beginning in the late 70s, technology transfer was very much a part of these market access deals.
Right.
What are some of the other things, Jeremy? What are some of the other things that China is getting wrong that it possibly, you know, should be doing better? Maybe areas like transparency, right?
Well, transparency, sure. I mean, that, yes, of course, transparency. But I mean, I don't think there is. I think you've struck at the nub of it. Is, you know, are Africans and African countries going to be better off as a result of this activity? And the answer to that will hinge on a few things: technology transfer and training, being able to create, you know, sustainable businesses aside from just getting rocks and taking them away to China. Locating manufacturing plants in Africa instead of just taking rocks and processing them somewhere else. And I think it's a little early to tell, you know, if it's going to work or not. I mean, it's not new, as you pointed out earlier. It's not totally new, but it's still pretty new. I mean, at least the levels of Chinese involvement in Africa today are something that 10 years ago, I think everybody would have been surprised to see how quickly the relationships have developed.
One test is also if demand for commodities falls or if China is not there seeking copper and oil, what's going to happen in these countries? I mean, I think that may be one measure as well in 20 years. Are they going to have other industries, other sources of economic strength?
Right. I mean, there have been previous periods of great hope in Africa, right? I mean, give us some historical context. Where there was investment, there was, you know, Western companies coming in, making big deals with governments.
I don't know if there's ever been any period of hope in Africa's history, to be honest. But, I mean, I think the independence period, when there were new countries newly independent, was one time of great hope in Africa. Unfortunately, it was also a time when, you know, it was the height of the Cold War. And,
right, the 60s and 70s we're talking about.
The 60s and 70s. And it was not a time when governments were making rational decisions. And everything was perverted by the Cold War.
And they were organizing policy around winning hearts and minds or winning proxy states in Africa. And today, I mean, there's a parallel, I suppose. People often frame the China and Africa story in terms of Chinese soft power. And perhaps we can end our conversation today before we all die of heat stroke in here. About South Africa. I mean, I'm sorry, about... Perhaps we can end our conversation here on this topic of soft power. We often frame it in terms of the efforts to win the hearts and minds of Africa. This is part of this grand soft power campaign on the part of China to win the love through force or through payments, but rather by attraction. We've talked about soft power quite a bit on this podcast. Are they building bridges in any more than the very perfectly literal sense of, you know, the infrastructure? Are they building bridges to the African people? Are they winning the affections of people in different geographies around Africa? What's your sense of that, just from where you've been, Shannon?
Maybe not in Zambia right now,
but probably not in Zambia.
But I had dinner with a Chinese researcher. He's doing a lot of work for Ian Taylor in Liberia. And he said something to me which I thought was really interesting. He said that the Americans try to win friendships through force, and Chinese try to win friendships through business. It's a different way of doing it.
Gadi, do you have thoughts on this? Soft power success so far?
Well, obviously, I haven't been on the ground in Africa as Shannon has been, and I didn't grow up there as Jeremy's. They're better qualified. But I have to respond to that notion that America tries to win friends through force just because they're represented by their military in some of these cases. I mean, I would say you can't really kind of judge, I think, the
just
motivations
because they're in uniform
or intentions based on a uniform or whether they're coming with a Chinese state-owned enterprise. I would say you could actually get sort of the intentions inverted based on judging on by their cover or what uniform they're wearing. But I think there is a fair point to be made about, you know, the West has come in with conditions over the years, and there's a there's a legitimate question about whether those the lending and the kind of conditions attached by the IMF and the World Bank over the years have been helpful or not. And I think there's real disagreement about that. And now we're going to have a real test of whether unconditional love from China actually helps or hurts. And I think, as Jeremy said, it really is way too early to tell. We'll have to see in about 10 or 20 years.
Jeremy, last word goes to you.
I'd just like to add one thing we haven't talked about. We've talked about Chinese in Africa. We haven't really talked about Africans in China. And in terms of
that's next week
building bridges, China has, I think, since the 60s, given scholarships to people from African countries
that's
to
right.
study here. And there's still a lot of scholarships available. And there are increasing numbers of young Africans who study in China, often funded by the Chinese government. There are also increasing numbers of African business people in China. And I think that China's most successful bridge building has actually been with Africans who have come to China and spent some time here and have realized that being an African in China, although there's a lot of what I would call casual racism, at the end of the day, if you want to do business, Chinese people will talk to you, which is a very different experience. If you're a Nigerian and you go to Europe, people assume that you're involved in some kind of fraud.
Someone knock off clutch bags or something.
Well, you're a criminal of some yeah. kind. Whereas Chinese don't actually make that assumption. They deal with African businessmen as people who can bring them commerce. And that is a very refreshing thing for an African businessman.
I think I know we said we'd give Jeremy the last word, but I can't resist. In my, you know, I'm going to exercise co-host prerogative here.
And you have a beard, so
and
you're
I have
a figure of authority.
So you're
you
much more intimidating now.
And, of course, much more wise. I think Shannon made an excellent point about what happens when commodity prices go down. I think we can't just assume a straight trend line here of Chinese taking over the world and resource prices going up, and they're having this sort of win-win, supposedly, relationship with Africa. I think if everything goes off the rails, things could get ugly.
You really know who your friends are then.
In Warren Buffett's memorable phrase, when the tide goes out, you see who's been swimming naked.
Exactly, and that is a good point to end on.
It is indeed. Shannon, thanks so much for coming. It was a real pleasure to meet you, and we look forward to having you on again and to hear about your travels this fall. Gadi, thanks again for co-hosting. And Jeremy, as usual, thanks very much for coming.
Thank you, Kaiser.
We will see you all next week, or you'll hear us all next week on the Seneca Podcast. Take care.